Today on the Syneos Health Podcast, we'll be talking about maintaining clinical trial continuity during a pandemic, the next in our coronavirus COVID-19 series. I'm Jeff Stewart from Syneos Health Consulting. Continuity is the lifeblood of a clinical trial. Data must be available, otherwise a clinical trial doesn't read out, patients don't get drug, and we don't know whether or not a drug works or is safe. How do we maintain continuity during the COVID-19 pandemic? I'll be joined today by two people who know that answer. The first is Nicole Stansbury, who is the head of our Global Centralized Monitoring Group. That function is basically the dashboard that she oversees to watch as clinical trials in near real time are working properly. I'll also be joined by Paul Colvin, who is the president of our clinical services. If you like what you're hearing, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Continuity in clinical trials with COVID-19 next on the Syneos Health Podcast. Paul Colvin, Nicole Stansbury, welcome to the Syneos Health Podcast.
Hi there.
Thank you very much.
I don't know what central monitoring is. What does that mean?
Central monitoring is a group that looks at data that's been accumulating over the course of the trial. And we look at that through analytical dashboards to assess trends, outliers, really glean additional insights and information into that data. And we can do that either on a per patient basis. We can look at trends within a patient. We can look at trends within a site, or we can look at trends across the entire population, or break that down by country, region, a subset of the population, like males or females, et cetera. It's really a very dynamic way of looking at data to interrogate the questions that we have and assess compliance, identify protocol deviations, alert sites to performance concerns and trends, all of those kinds of things.
I don't understand how clinical trials can really continue through something like a pandemic. I don't know how the data get captured. I don't know how at the end of the day you can make a scientific decision. So help me. How do you do that?
I think from the healthcare system in general, there's a continuity of care that needs to occur, and there's a prioritization that's happening in the healthcare public health environment as it is. So patients that are in critical need of care and oversight from a safety perspective, those patients are being prioritized. The care is still continuing, whether they're a clinical patient or in some cases in a critical setting, a research patient. And I think that there's some of that that's occurring, as well as the less critical research trials at the moment. There are ways that we can supplement some of that through a short period of time where they might have to have a missed procedure. But we're anticipating that it'll be a short period of time and a rolling period of time where it's not affecting the entire globe, the entire amount of time, but it's rolling. You might have one or two missed monthly visits or assessments in China, and then that may move to South Korea and China gets back up online and those kinds of things.
Yeah, I really would say it's easy to get lost in the enormity of the situation. This is an unprecedented event. And I think what's important right now is that we all focus on the tasks in front of us, what we can do to keep trial continuity in place. And I think if we break it down into the basic components that we need around monitoring and focusing on the events within the sites we're managing and the country where each person is living, you can really break that down into fundamental components. We just don't want to get lost in that bigger picture right now because it is a lot when you look at it from the enormity of the event that's occurring. So we're really trying to provide tools to allow people to be very focused on what is that task that we need to complete at each site in order to make the trial viable and ensure the data is usable for submissions going forward with regulatory agencies.
I feel as though I've put the cart before the horse a little bit when we talk about how we solve a problem. I really didn't describe the problem. Can you tell me what is this problem? We've talked a bit about it already on the podcast. What is trial continuity? Why is it so important? And then we can talk a little bit more about what the heck we do about it.
I think the first thing that started were some local travel restrictions and quarantines in certain areas. There were then hospitals that started to close their doors to visitors, meaning monitors as well. There are patients who, even though they can access medical facilities, they're being assessed as to whether or not it's prudent for them to attend and visit hospital and clinic settings. So I think in a number of different ways, there are some different impacts that are happening.
When I think of volunteers, and that's what all the patients, the that join each study are volunteers who have volunteered to take experimental medications in a hope that they can be a part of bringing a new medicine that can change our current standard of therapy, right? And I think what's really important at this time is our obligation to ensure that each of those patients that's volunteered, that their data is still usable. The worst kind of loss in my mind is when we are wasting patient data and that data can't be used because it's either not been validated or been lost to follow up. I think even during this time, if we can continue the continuity of these studies, we ensure there aren't delays in approvals of new medicines and put the patient and the value that they've put in volunteering their time and their efforts so that that's not lost as well. So I see a real opportunity for us to help society advance medicine and through keeping these trials moving and the continuity and the safety of those patients in mind, we have a big role to play.
I try to put a problem like this into categories so I can understand the problem in ways that might be meaningful and we can have some kind of action against them. When we think about this problem, I have to imagine the devil's in the details with a lot of these, that some trials will be at no risk whatsoever. They don't have any issues particularly. I don't know what those trials are, but there have to be some. And then there are some that with delays can be okay. You can have a pause and then you can come back to them. And a delay is nothing anybody wants, but, you know, pandemic. So it's there, but you still have data continuity that you can maintain. And then others have, I need a follow-up in the protocol and my primary endpoint is 180 days later in the hospital in a respiratory unit or something like that. And that's not going to be available. Do you think about the problem that way? And if so, how do I know if I've got a trial ongoing that I'm in the good bucket, the I can wait a while bucket and it'll still work, and the bucket of, wow, we have to change something?
Well, I think we're looking at the risks for each individual trial very carefully. And we're discussing those with the full complement of the experts around the table supporting that team, whether it be the statisticians, the medical monitors, and the investigative sites themselves. I mean, we have to keep in mind that there are some sites in some regions that really have not seen a major impact at this point at all. So that's part of it. So we may not see all the data be impacted. I think that's one thing, being really careful not to expand the impact and across every site, every region the same way, because we just can get a little bit ahead of ourselves, I think, if we do that. But I think having that risk assessment very carefully involving the entire team, staying in close communication with the sites. Just as an example, in an oncology study, asking the sites what they're doing with their clinic patients now, patients that are not part of a clinical trial, how are they continuing their care? We want the sites to appreciate some of the things that they are doing with their clinic patients and making sure that they can provide that same continuity with research patients. So if they're making accommodations to ensure that their current chemotherapy patients that are not in a clinical trial are coming in and having that continuity of care, we can work very closely with those sites and help to ensure that the same continuity is occurring for those research patients as well. Whether that's additional protective equipment being used, scheduling certain time periods for them to arrive, additional cleaning around the facility, those kinds of things to make sure that that continuity happens. So I think really working carefully and closely with each individual site that's impacted is providing a good amount of information to that full cross-functional team of statisticians and medical experts to assess what the true potential impact is.
Paul?
I agree with what Nicole said. I think that at this time, there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. As you think about each individual trial, it's going to have different needs and components. As this virus goes across the planet, we're going to have different needs in each country at times. So as we build this model, I think, as Nicole pointed out, I think we have to have flexibility. We have to assess each individual protocol, the situation in each country during each time period. And it's very fluid. That could change from 1 week to the next. So I think it'll be important for us to stay very aware of the progress of this in each country and continue to assess and to really revamp our monitoring plans for each protocol as this continues. It's my hope that we'll see this clear up in the next couple of months and it will be back to business as usual. But I think we need to be prepared that it could be longer, and we need to continue to reassess our monitoring plans really on a weekly basis as we see this fluid situation change.
If I'm thinking about phase one trials, I'm thinking that in areas that are affected, you just don't have them. Am I wrong on that? And this is basically, I don't want to say whack-a-mole, but it's the moving party of where phase one trials might be in places that are no longer affected. And where they are affected, you probably don't initiate trials. Am I wrong in that? Or is phase one still something that you tend to run through something like a pandemic?
It really depends, because it depends on the therapeutic area. If you're looking at an oncology study, that's typically not going to be done in a clinic where you're going to bring a lot of healthy volunteers together. I think what we've seen is in those indications like oncology, where you're working in an individual and independent site, I think you're still seeing that work, a lot of it's continuing. Where I think we've seen, for example, in our clinics and in most phase one clinics that are treating healthy volunteers, they don't want to bring, one, a burden onto the healthcare teams, and two, that you don't want to bring those people into group settings within a phase one clinic. That's the reason we made the decision to close down our clinics at this time, is we did not want to bring all of those patients into a central location at the time as the virus is breaking. And we'll be evaluating that every week until we feel it's safe to go back.
And the guidance from the regulatory authority is really encouraging that sort of risk analysis and starting new trials right now, and really trying to assess what's the likelihood that the trial will be interrupted. Because if we can wait another 2 months and then initiate a trial where we can guarantee the probability of it being interrupted is much less, then that's the smarter move to make. And we can take this time now in coming up with a better, more rapid recruitment strategy, for example, that helps to keep that overall project on time and on target, rather than jeopardizing the data collection or patient safety by initiating a trial at this time with so many unknown factors.
So that's phase one, which, depending on the type of trial, you either just go full speed ahead or you stop. It's kind of one or the other, it sounds like, and potentially different areas of the globe can open up for phase one trials as the COVID-19 pandemic works its way around. We'll come to phase three in a minute. Phase two strikes me as being the one that is most at risk from a scientific level, even though phase three is longer. Because phase three, you have more data points to work with. Phase two, it's kind of hit or miss, right? Whether or not you're going to be able to get on a scientific level the answer. And so strikes me as being the one that's going to be the most sensitive to this risk. Also because it's shorter. So if it happens during the trial, then more of your data potentially can be impacted. Am I thinking remotely about this correctly?
It continues to go back to each individual study assessment. It's just so hard to answer on a broad scale. And I think a lot of the regulatory authorities have continued to say that themselves. There's not a general guidance that they can issue. It's a lot of different factors that have to be considered. For example, if it's a respiratory trial, it's probably not the best time to initiate that, because what you're looking for and the symptoms and analyses may be a little bit more difficult to assess with the complexities that a virus is providing. It really just depends. I think it's a very detailed assessment of the risk and benefits.
Another thing I would add to that is I think about different phases. Our monitoring process isn't going to change based on the phase of the study. As you brought up phase ones are going to have a more intensive monitoring plan. But I don't think that fundamentally our philosophy on how we implement remote monitoring changes by phase. I think it really is, as Nicole has alluded to, it depends on the inclusion-exclusion criteria within each individual protocol and assessing the need for what type of data points are more important for that individual study. So I'm not sure phase would drive our decision-making as much as a therapeutic area and the protocol schedule of events that would really focus on how we would monitor differently.
Where do we go from here? How do we make trials into resilient trials? What are we learning that we can apply, and what new tools are we bringing to the table? I know it's only, well, what are we, couple weeks in the United States into a very serious event, and globally only a few months in. So this may be an unfair question, but what are we doing now that's different that we're trying to do to help?
Well, I think one of the things that this has taught all of us is the value of some of the new, I wouldn't say new, because they've been around and encouraged for probably close to 10 years now, but things like central monitoring.
For a person who is not in clinical, what is central monitoring?
Central monitoring is the review of data that's been captured through various systems or processes like the EDC system, the lab data, anything that we can access remotely in that data, that's what central monitoring is doing. It's looking at that accumulated data through the various sources, and we're putting it in tools that allow us to visualize that data in different ways to identify trends, outliers, identify protocol deviations, etc. And again, looking at it from the standpoint of we can look at those trends and identify deviations within a patient, within a site, within a country, or for the whole population. Tapping into more of those central monitoring type activities, which can reduce the need for 100% SDR and SDV. I think if we were more effectively and widely using those methodologies in the industry today, this would not be as impactful for us as it had been. But I think the industry has still been pretty slow to adopt central monitoring or risk-based monitoring approaches. Industry survey last year indicated that only about 60% of the trials are using central monitoring or risk-based monitoring approaches.
So the central monitoring sounds like a Waze app to me. It tells you where the traffic is and you need to move around it, or there's a problem. And you just didn't know that before because you'd get in a bunch of paperwork a while later and go, oh, wow, didn't work over here.
Exactly.
What are those acronyms that you're trying to avoid, the SDR and SDD?
So the SDR and SDV is reviewing 100% of all of the data in the medical record, and then the transcription of the data in the medical record into the electronic data capture system. Research has shown that once that data gets entered into the electronic data capture system or the EDC system, only about 4% of that data is ever changed. The industry has relied, it's been a gold standard for years, that you do 100% review of all the source documents, which are all the medical records, all the actual notes and medical history and chart and all of that kind of stuff, and then compare 100% of that to the data that's been entered into the EDC. And we're doing all that work and spending all that time when only about 4% of that data is ever changed in the EDC system after we perform that review. So the industry has said since about 2007, 2008, that a better way of doing that would be to look at trends and outliers and risks in the accumulated data from a centralized monitoring perspective, and then target very specific reviews of those source documents or medical records for review. So the SDR piece should be that targeted piece. And I think it's just taken a really long time for the industry to get there. But now, when we can't go on site in a lot of cases and have that direct access to those medical records, we're really learning how to rely on central monitoring. And I think people are realizing at this point, well, it really would have been good to have this in place before this pandemic started.
I think the way to think about it simply is, how can we get better virtual access to source data at a site? And how do we put algorithms around that so that we can validate that source data and ensure the data is as clean as it can be, so that when the analysis is done, it is accurate and it can meet the standards put in place by regulatory agencies around the world. And I want to say a thank you to the clinical group in general, because while, as Nicole's pointing out, there's room for the industry to improve, and we need to think about how we put those analytic tools in place for central monitoring, I think that the fact that we had already built out a lot of our tools allowed us to take a leadership position with ACRO, and Nicole and her team led the way to a large extent to work across all of the CROs and to work in partnership with the FDA and other regulatory agencies to put together a policy statement that I think the entire company has seen that really helps to make life easier for the sites. You don't have 16 different solutions that sites are trying to manage, but through the ACRO partnership, we've created a guideline that sites and all companies are using in a harmonized manner to really try to lower the burden on sites. So in a lot of ways, what Nicole and her team have been doing has enabled us to take that leadership position and put this guidance in place very quickly. And I think there will be a number of lessons learned from this exercise that we can use to better prepare for any similar events that would occur in the future. So while this is a difficult event to manage, I think we have to be very passionate about taking lessons learned, incorporating those back into our processes, and ensuring that we really improve and take our current processes to the next level. Not only so we're prepared for an event like this, but I think there's opportunities to lower site burden, lower patient burden, and help to bring new and exciting medicines to market in a much cheaper and more efficient manner.
Is this COVID-19 pandemic the hardest problem you've solved or faced in your careers?
No, I think the conversion of the ideals around how monitoring can and should be performed and access to data and how we analyze data has probably been a far more difficult problem to solve. And this, we're being able to tap into a lot of the things that we've been trying to solve over the course of the last few years and utilize them during this pandemic. We've been a little bit more prepared because of the hard work we've invested in some of the other more data technological areas to withstand something like this.
Paul?
I would say from my seat, this has probably been, if not the greatest, certainly in the very top of complexity and difficulty in managing this from a management position. I think that's because this is not only a challenge for us within our processes and within the industry's standard process, but it's a challenge for every individual on the globe. This has impacted everyone's personal life. Everyone is balancing being at home with their family 24 hours a day, working virtually, trying to balance the demands of their personal life and their professional life, and us each trying to do the best we can to, again, keep trials and trial continuity going forward, ensuring these medicines get to market, working through the logistics of ensuring every site has study drug continuity, ensuring that we have the right staffing in each country to meet the changing and fluid dynamic of this condition. So again, I have been amazed at seeing how everyone in the organization has stepped up and continues to volunteer to really help us manage this situation. We were able to move to virtual in a very seamless and fast manner, which I think helped us not have that spread of COVID-19 throughout our organization. But it's going to continue to be a challenge even post this event, because as we said, each country will come back online at a different rate. We'll have to manage through that. And when this event is over, there will be a large pent-up demand from our clients, from sites, and from patients that want to see these trials move forward faster again. So I would just ask everyone to continue what you're doing to help us manage through this difficult time. I think we will turn around much faster than other industries. And when we do, we will have to continue to find solutions for the new challenge, which will be bringing all of these trials back into active enrollment and ramping up for what we will have to do to really go back and do some of the on-site SDV and other work that we simply can't do remotely. So I would just ask everyone to stay with us. Thank you for all of your continued dedicated support to make this happen. And we'll get through this together. We're all in the same boat. We're all on the same team. And I know that together we'll be successful.
Paul Colvin, Nicole Stansbury, thank you so much for joining me on the Syneos Health Podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That's all for today's episode of the Syneos Health Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Stewart from Syneos Health Consulting. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. If you have comments, suggestions, questions, or if you just want to talk through a particular challenge that you're having at your life sciences company, you may email me at podcast@syneoshealth.com. We're consultants. That's what we do.